Let's open our Bibles up to the book of Matthew once again. Matthew chapter 26. We are going to deal with just five verses this morning. I expected an amen right there, and I didn't get one. Just five verses before us, and I want to deal with them separately. I want to deal with them. It's tempting, and when you look at how other better preachers, more experienced pastors deal with the text, many of them include this in other messages, but I really want to deal with them separately as a standalone, and they are a standalone. What's the word I'm looking for? This is a division in the text. This is a separate incident that takes place. And what it deals with is Jesus prophesying that they would fall away from him. They would flee. And he's telling them this before they do it. And they all argue with him and tell him he's wrong. Now, just a heads up before we go any further. If you tell Jesus he's wrong, you're not only wrong, you're dumb. Okay? And so I want us to look at this, and I have a title of this, When Willpower Ain't Enough. When Willpower Ain't Enough. That's the title of the message, and that's what I want us to learn from this text. So let's begin reading in verse 31 of Matthew 26, and we'll read through verse 35. Then saith Jesus unto them, All ye shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered abroad. But after I am risen again, I will go before you into Galilee. Peter answered and said unto him, Though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet will I never be offended. Jesus said unto him, Verily I say unto thee, that this night, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Peter said unto him, Though I should die with thee, yet I will not deny thee. Likewise also said all the disciples. Now I'll remind you where we are in the life of Jesus Christ. He has gathered together his 12 apostles in an upper room to partake of the Lord's Supper. They knew it to be the Passover, but he instituted the Lord's Supper. He separated Judas out of the mix and said, Go and do what you've proposed to do in your heart. So Jesus went to find the leaders of the Pharisees to lead them to Jesus and to betray Jesus and hand him over for the price of 30 pieces of silver. And so while Judas is away, Jesus gathers up the 11 and says, Let's go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And so while they're going to the Garden of Gethsemane, and Gethsemane means olive press, so they're going to the Garden of the Olive Press, and while they're heading there to this place, he stops and prays with them, and that prayer is recorded in John 17, and that truly is the Lord's Prayer. When the Lord teaches us how to pray, that's not his prayer, that's how we are to pray. But in John 17, he prays for his apostles, and he's doing this on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's teaching them, and you'll find his teaching in this night that's found between John chapter 13 and John chapter 17. And so Jesus is doing this teaching on his way there and with these apostles. And then he says, by the way, you're all going to flee tonight. You're all going to take off and run. You're all going to deny me. Everything's going to go away. And you're all going to act like you never knew me. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Now, the first point that I have is this, a perplexing problem. I want to deal with this problem before I deal with the text. I want to point out a problem before I deal with the text. The perplexing problem is this, Jesus is sovereignly telling them that they are going to try to do what's right and fail at it. Doesn't the Bible tell us to stay with Jesus? Stand ye in the ways and seek which way is the good way and go therein. Jesus is saying you're all going to fall away from me. And they're going, no, we're not. We're going to stay with you forever. Folks, that is a good idea. That is a good plan. That's what we should be doing. Well, here's what Jesus says to that. He says, no, you're not. You're going to forsake me. Now, folks, we got a real problem on our hands. These 11 men are trying to do what the Bible tells them to do, what God has proposed in their heart for them to do. And yet Jesus says, you're not going to do what's right that you're proposing to do in your heart and that you decide to do with all your might. You're not going to do it. Now here's the problem we run into. How can this be? How can it be God's will and God's prophecy and God's plan for His people not to do what He's told them they ought to do? Now, I've got a preacher friend, and here's what he says. Anytime he encounters something like this in the Gospels, here's his simple answer. Well, the apostles aren't saved yet. They're lost, and lost people do that. Well, I hate to tell him this. No, I don't hate to tell him. I like to tell him. I tell him every time I get the chance to tell him. Let's be honest here. Who am I kidding? You know me better than this. Every time we get together and he says, well, the apostles are lost. And they're acting like lost people because they're lost. Because saved people wouldn't turn away from Christ. I'm like, newsflash, bud. Saved people turn away from Christ all the time. And there's no possible way that these 11 disciples are lost because Peter's already made a profession of faith. And his profession of faith was valid. Because Jesus said it was. Peter said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And what Jesus say? Blessed art thou, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood didn't reveal it to thee, but my Father which is in heaven. So Jesus says, Peter, your profession of faith is not of your own will. It is through the working of God in your life, convincing you of who I am. That is an answer to the gospel. People who believe that and profess that are saved people. So it's real easy to go, well, they're lost. That's why they fell away. Lost people always fall away. They're not lost. There was one lost and he's been separated. We're talking about 11 saved people. Now here's the next objection that I anticipate when people don't understand how this works. They say this. Well, that's you and that sovereignty of God business you believe. You believe that God's sovereign, and when God's sovereign, He just makes people do stuff against their will. Even when they want to do what's right, God makes them not do it. God sends people to hell even when they really want to go to heaven. God says, no, I didn't die for you. You're going to hell against your will. Folks, you'll never find one shred of that logic anywhere in Scripture. I believe as God is sovereign over all events, and all events work according to the will of God. But here's what else I believe. I don't believe God has ever forced anybody to sin. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a Bible verse that backs my opinion. When thou art tempted, do not say that it is God who tempts me. For the Lord does not tempt thee. You by your own desires, your own lust, your own wishes, do that which is evil. When you are tempted, know that you're not tempted by anything except that which is common to man. So God is not sovereignly forcing these 11 disciples to defect from God. Instead, God is working out His sovereign plan as prophesied before Christ ever set foot on the earth. And He's not causing these people to forsake His Son and cause them to do that which the Bible tells them not to do. God's not forcing them to do that. You say, well, Brother Harold, how in the world can God be sovereign over all things and not be responsible for when people disobey Him? I'm glad you asked. I want to give you an answer. And I want to give you an answer by my second point, and it's found in verses 31 and 32. I want to give you a peek into His plan. The perplexing problem is settled when you get a peek into God's plan. When you have trouble discerning what God's doing, read His book. You'll get your answer. When God tells you what He's going to do and you wonder why things are going the way they are, read what God's planning on doing. So let's read verses 31 and 32 and let's get a peek into His plan. Then saith Jesus unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. But after I am risen again, I will go before you into Galilee. First thing, first thing that you and I need to look at is Jesus says unto them, all of you shall be offended because of me this night. He's given them a prophecy, and he's given it to them with a time frame, and the time frame is tonight. Why is he saying that? Because he's about to be arrested, and tomorrow he's going to be crucified. And he says, tonight, all of you will be offended. That word offended means stumbled. It means trapped. It means all of you are going to fall for a trap. All of you are going to trip and stumble and do what you shouldn't do. All of you are going to do wrong. You say, well, Brother Harold, they want to do right. How is it that they're doing wrong? Why is God causing them to do wrong? God's not causing them to do wrong. They're doing wrong of their own. Look what he says. He gives us a prophecy from Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. He quotes the first part of that verse. He says, for it is written, I will smite the shepherd and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. Who is God causing to do something? He's causing the shepherd to do something. God says, I'm going to smite the shepherd. Did he smite the flock? No. Who did he smite? Shepherd. Now, who's the shepherd in this instance? Jesus. God punishes Christ, and look at what happens to the sheep, which are the disciples. They flee. Now, God didn't say, I'm going to smite the shepherd, and I'm going to shove all these sheep out in the wilderness. All God does is smite the shepherd, and the sheep do what sheep normally do without a shepherd. God's not making the sheep do wrong. God's just taking the shepherd away, and sheep are acting like sheep. Do you want me to tell you why the world is the way it is? Because God has taken his hand off of it and is letting people do what people want to do. You say, Brother Harold, I don't believe that. Then why in the world do you pray that God get involved in the events of the world? Because you don't like where it's going without him involved. Why do you pray so hard when we have a presidential election? Because you don't want the rest of this country picking your president. That's why. You want God to somehow miraculously come down and convince a bunch of pagans to vote like a bunch of Christians so that we get a president that halfway respects our views. And you ought to pray that. But you ought not be surprised when we get a bad one. And if you haven't prayed that we get a good one, you shouldn't be disappointed with the results. Because that's what lost people do when God doesn't get involved and calls them to do something that God wants. In other words, all God has to do to see wickedness go rampant in the world is take his hands off of things and allow them to go that way. Do you realize, Christian, why the Bible calls you salt and light? It calls you salt because you slow rot. Your presence prevents decay. And by decay, I mean moral decay. The Bible calls you light because your presence illuminates sin and illuminates God. And the less of us that there are in the world, the more rotten it is and the more dark it is. You want to know why our country's in the shape it's in? Because there's not as many real Christians as this country in this country as the polls say that there are. If there were 15.8 million Southern Baptists, the South would look different. A peek into his plan. Jesus says here, you're all going to fall. And you're going to fall because I'm going to be struck. And when I'm struck, you're going to go back to doing what you wanted to do. Do you realize that none of these people came and followed Christ of their own will? Jesus wasn't out there like the Marines looking for a few good men. He wasn't taking volunteers. Matter of fact, when people volunteered, he talked them out of it. Jesus was drafting people. Come, follow me. That wasn't an invitation, that was a command. Nobody that Jesus ever said, come follow me to, said, no, I'm not doing that. No. When he made the general statement of come follow me, people said, hey, I'll do it, but let me go bury my father first. He said, you don't want to follow me. If you want to follow me, just get up and follow me. But when he goes to these 12 and he says, come follow me, they get up and say, yes, sir, right away, sir. peek into his plan. Let's go back and look at Zechariah 13, verse 7. It's just a few books back into the Old Testament. Not so far as to get scared by that mean old God of the Old Testament. That was a joke. The Methodist will get it. Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. Awake, O sword. This is God the Father talking to his own sword. It is not merely the Jews that are striking Christ. It is not merely the Romans that are striking Christ. It is God the Father that is striking Christ. It is God the Father punishing his own son for the deeds of us. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man that is my fellow. You know what that really says in the Hebrew? It doesn't say against my old buddy, my fishing buddy, my fellow. It says against my union, my equal, my same. This can be translated no other way in awake, O sword, and kill part of the Godhead, the Trinity. Awake, O my soul, O my sword, and kill the shepherd. The shepherd is none other than Christ. It is God the Father saying that he is going to smite his own son, who is the shepherd of the sheep. And notice what happens when the shepherd is taken away. The sheep scatter. God doesn't say, now I know y'all want to follow Christ, but I'm not going to let you follow Christ. All God says is, I'm going to take Christ away. And you know what happens when Christ is taken away? I don't care how strong you are, Christian. I don't care what your record is. I don't care what your reputation is. If God were to take his hand off you for 30 seconds, you'd hit the gutter so fast your head would spin. It is the grace of God that you are what you are. But notice what God says in this text. The sheep will scatter and I will turn my hand upon the little ones. I don't really know what that means, I thought. He's going to kill a shepherd and then turn around and kill all the sheep too? No, when you get an understanding of I will turn my hand upon the little ones, it means that after I smite the shepherd, I'm not going to forget about the sheep. I'm going to smite the shepherd and then I'm going to gather up all the sheep and I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to bring them all back together. I'm going to see that those sheep are taken care of. I'm going to see that those sheep are nurtured. Now, go back to our text and look at what Christ says. After quoting Zechariah 13:7, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. Verse 32, but after I'm risen again, I will go before you to Galilee. Jesus is saying, I'm going to be smitten, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to die, but I'm going to rise again. And I'm going to go before you into Galilee. So that means they're still going to be around and they're going to go to Galilee too. And they're all going to be together in Galilee when it's over. That's exactly what it said in Zechariah 13:7. I'm going to smite the shepherd, but I'm going to turn my hand and gather together all of the sheep together. And that's exactly what Jesus says that he's going to do here. So what's his plan? I'm going to die. You're going to forsake me and act like you never knew me. You're going to give me the cold shoulder. But after I die, I'm going to rise again. Then I'm going to go to Galilee. Then y'all are going to go to Galilee. And then we're all going to be together in Galilee for a little while. Is that what happened, preacher? It is. Matter of fact, Jesus was a little more gracious than that. When he came out of the grave, he appeared to Mary Magdalene. He said, go and tell my disciples and Peter that I'm alive. And then they all run down there and they see the empty grave, they see the empty clothes. And one of them says, you know, I can't believe this. So they all go back and they lock themselves in a room and they're sitting there at night and they're like, oh, you know, what's going on? What's going on? Jesus says, peace be with you. He shows up in a locked room. And they're like, it's a ghost. And he's, I'm not a ghost. Give me something to eat. They give him a piece of fish. He eats it. It doesn't fall to the floor. He talks to him. Then he leaves again. Then Thomas shows up because there's only 10 in the upper room. I don't believe that for a minute unless I see his hands and I see his side. I don't believe that. 7 days later, peace be with you. Hey, Thomas, was there something you wanted to see on me? Go ahead, put your hand right here. No, my Lord and my God, he says. And then some time goes by. And Peter gets the idea that he says, you know what? I'm just going to go fishing. The only place Peter knew where to fish was in Galilee. Peter went to Galilee to go fishing. Y'all can just skip the remaining sermons out of this Bible. Just come back when we start the next book. He says, I'm going to go fishing. The only place I know to fish, and the only place my boats and nets and stuff are in Galilee. It's family fish business. So everybody follows him there. James and John are fishermen anyway, so they're all back home in Galilee. They're all fishing. They're going to try to go on, you know, business as usual. They fish all night. They catch nothing. They're tired. They're like, we don't know what to do. We stayed in Jerusalem, nothing. We come up here, we fish, nothing. It's getting daylight. You fish at night. Some old dude's on the bank going, hey, did y'all catch anything? And they're like, no, we fished all night. We didn't catch anything. He said, you need to fish on the other side of the boat. That's kind of smart, Alec, if it was real life. That's essentially saying you're not holding your mouth right. He's like, go ahead, fish on the other side of the boat. The boats that they were fishing out of were about as wide as three pulpits. What's 6 foot going to make a difference? So they drop their net down to please the old guy on the bank. They drop their net down on the other side, and they got so many fish in it that they can't pull it up. And while they're trying to pull this net up, one of them goes, that's Jesus on the bank. Where? In Galilee. Why in Galilee? He said he'd meet us here. They were supposed to go to Galilee to meet Christ. And said they went to Galilee to fish. Yet another instance where you do what seems right to you. And you accomplish God's purpose and show up where he said you'd show up. He didn't drag them there kicking and screaming, we don't want to go to Galilee. Why are you making us go to Galilee? Instead, they said, let's go to Galilee and fish, see what happens. Ta-da! Where you're supposed to be. Right on time. How do you know he's right on time, preacher? When they got to the bank, he had a fire going and fish that was already cooked. He didn't need what was in their net. He already had breakfast ready. He gave them a peek into his plan, and they said, oh, no, 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 no. We won't desert you, and we won't go to Galilee to meet with you. We'll do it our way. Fair enough, see you in Galilee. So let's answer our perplexing problem by our first point. Were they lost? I don't think so. If they were, it's the most interest that God's ever put in a lost man in the history of Scripture. It's the most love God's ever shown for a lost man in the history of Scripture. Well, did God drag them kicking and screaming to do things they didn't want to do? No, they naturally did what God said they would do, and they didn't complain about it. They didn't fuss about it. They just did it. They did it to suit their own wishes and their own wants, and it was exactly what God said they would do. Now, when God says he's going to do something, and you say, well, I don't think so. God doesn't say, well, I guess I better refigure this. Boy, Harold, I had you penciled in for Monday. What are we going to do here? No, he tells them. Now, here's where Peter does what Peter's good at, something stupid. John MacArthur calls Peter, in his book, 12 Ordinary Men, he calls Peter the apostle with a foot-shaped mouth because he's constantly sticking his foot in his mouth, so to speak. Let's look at Peter's pronouncement, point number three. Peter's pronouncement, verse 33. Peter answered and said unto him, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet I will never be offended. Everybody might stumble over you, but I'll never stumble. Everybody might fall for that trap, but I'll not fall for that trap. I'm going to tell you something. I think Peter means what he says and says what he means here. I'm going to tell you something. I think Peter is speaking from his heart. I don't think Peter's going, well, I'm going to show everybody else who I am. Peter's not saying this for effect. Peter's not saying this so somebody else hears him. Peter's not trying to impress his friends. Peter's not trying to convince Christ. Peter is honestly saying, when he hears that we're all going to defend Christ, he says, everybody else might, but there's absolutely no way that I could. There's no way. This is his pronouncement. Just as matter of fact, as Jesus made this prophecy and this peek into his plan, and he's even quoting the Old Testament to prove it, Peter says, well, that'll never happen with me. Now the question comes to mind here. Jesus is the leader. The apostles are his followers. And Jesus is saying, all my followers are going to run off. And his followers are saying, no, we're not. And Jesus says, yeah, you are. This would essentially make Jesus look like a pretty sorry leader. It would make his followers look like pretty weak followers, wouldn't it? You know, we learned something in Desert Storm. In Desert Storm, we were fighting Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi army. And Saddam Hussein was a dictator. He was a despot. He forced his people to do what they didn't want to do. They didn't want to fight America. Nobody wants to fight America. Some leader may want to fight America, but the guys on the ground, they don't want to fight America. Why? They watched us fight the Japs. They watched us fight the Nazis. Nobody wants to fight America. Some leader may want to fight America. So you know what we learned in Desert Storm? The Iraqi army would be spread out in the desert. There'd be one guy out there with some shiny stuff on the corners of his coat. He'd be an officer. He'd be standing up in an open-top Jeep with two flags flying. Iraqi army. He'd have a set of field glasses and he'd be looking over the American troops across the desert. And beside him would be a whole host of Iraqi soldiers. Coming over the mountain would be an A-10 Warthog, a tank destroyer. And when it would top that hill, it'd immediately spot that Jeep with the flag that said officer in Iraqi army. And it'd open up that rotary cannon on the front of that airplane and it'd sound like this. Burr. That was 500 rounds being launched all in about a half a second. And everything around that Jeep would blow up and that Iraqi officer would lay dead over the hood of that Jeep. And all the men would say, now that he's gone, we give up. We didn't want to fight anyways. They were only fighting because the officer said, if you leave, I'll kill you. Well, as soon as somebody killed the officer, they all gave up. Do you know what America began to do? Who's in charge over there? That guy, kill him. Bam, he's dead. Everybody else raises the white flag. We marched across the desert, not killing armies, killing individual men. When enough individual men died, the rest of the individual men said, you know what? They're just shooting us that are in charge. They got out their pocket knife, started cutting off them bars. I'm just one of the average guys. It would appear to me that the disciples were no better than the Iraqi army. As soon as you took the shepherd, they scattered. They gave up. They surrendered. Jesus said, this is exactly what's going to happen. You know what Peter is saying in his heart? I'm not a member of the Iraqi army. I'm not out here against my will. I'm not just following you around because I don't have somewhere else to be. I'm doing this because I want to. I'm following you because thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. I'm following you because to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of life. That's what Peter said. But it would appear at a face reading that Jesus is the commander of a despot army. And that his followers and his soldiers are nothing more than drafted individuals that want to go home. Why in the world would the Bible record such an event? The Bible not only records it, the Bible recorded it hundreds of years before it happened. Why? He's telling them this because he's showing them their weakness. He's showing them that this is the way it's supposed to be. This is not an accident. This is not even an incident. This is the way God designed it to happen. He gives them a peek into his plan and Peter says, oh no. No, I'm going to fight to the death, bud. You don't know who you drafted here. I'm the Chuck Norris of the apostles. I might go missing in action, but I'm still fighting. So he says, though all men shall be offended because of thee, yet I will never be offended. Jesus gives Peter a personal prophecy. Personal prophecy, point number four. Verse 34. Jesus said unto him, Verily I say unto thee, that this night, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. That's three times. Before the rooster crows, it's already dark. They didn't take this Passover Lord's Supper until after sundown because that started the day of Passover. So it was dark. They dismissed Judas. They had the Lord's Supper. They ate together. They had the Lord's Supper. They sang a hymn. They left. Jesus gives them verses 13 through 17 of John in private teaching. Then Jesus begins here and he says, before daylight. I can't imagine what time of the night it must be now. Jesus is going to go pray and then be arrested. And Jesus says, Peter, you're not only going to deny me, you're going to deny me before daylight. I don't know how many of you have ever lived on a farm or within earshot of a farm. But I always thought growing up as a kid that roosters didn't crow until the sun came up. Then I got a rooster. And I learned that the sun came up when the rooster started crowing. Because he started crowing before the sun came up. He was ready to get up a long time before the sun came up. Every rooster I've ever had, every rooster I've ever heard was crowing in the dark before sun up. Jesus says before the sun even starts to crawl over those mountains. In the east, you're going to say you don't know me three times. You know, people are always taking prophecies out of context and applying them to themselves. I know my thoughts toward you, thoughts of good, not evil. Why don't anybody take this personal prophecy to Peter and apply it to themselves? Oh, well, preacher, that's to Peter. Let me tell you something, sir. That passage in Jeremiah was to the Jews. That passage in 2 Chronicles 7:14, that wasn't to the United States of America. Unless you're willing to take Peter's prophecy and hang your hat on it, leave the rest of them where they belong. Was this prophecy made to Peter? Did it come true? Oh, absolutely, preacher. Let me tell you something. Those prophecies in the Old Testament were made to Jews and they came true and they're not meant to be applied to you and I. We have this personal prophecy. Interesting that Jesus, to prove that he's supposed to be struck down and they're supposed to scatter away, even though they don't want to, Jesus quotes something that was written by Zechariah over 500 years prior. You look here, Jesus gives a personal prophecy given to one person that takes place in the next couple hours. Jesus doesn't have to quote the Old Testament. Everything Jesus says comes true. Everything Jesus says is true. He quotes the Old Testament because he came not to do his own will, but the will of him that sent him. Personal prophecy. Three times tonight, before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me. Now when you stand up in front of your friends and call Jesus a liar, don't be shocked if Jesus stands up and proves you to be an idiot. Just a little, you know, wisdom along your way. If you stand up before your friends and call Jesus a liar, you might get prophesied over that you'll become an idiot. Jesus is not going to allow Peter to continue to say these things. And so he has to stand up and say, this is the way it's going to be. Now, we know, because this is a past event, that we can verify, did they scatter? Yes. Did God strike down Christ? Yes. Did Peter deny him three times? Yes. We know who wins the argument. Yet Peter's not done. And not only is Peter not done, the people are following him. I would like to think if I were there and I were John, I'd say, Peter, maybe you should just shut up. Peter, every time you do this, you look stupid. Peter, remember last time you said this? That's not what happens. My fifth and final point is this. A proud persistence. A proud persistence. Look with me at verse 35. Peter said unto him, Though I should die with thee, yet I will not deny thee. The most shocking thing in the text is this last phrase. Likewise also said all the disciples. All 11 said, we ain't denying you. We're dying here on the mountain tonight. Peter wasn't convinced. The other apostles weren't convinced. Peter put his hand where his mouth was. When they showed up to arrest Christ, you read the end of the chapter, when they showed up to arrest Christ, they laid hands on Jesus and Peter pulled back his jacket and he had him a sword in there. And he reared back and he took a dead level swing at the servant, the personal servant of the high priest, the highest ranking Jewish officer in the entire nation of Israel. Peter tried to cut the head off the man. I'm telling you, he's the Chuck Norris of the apostles. I want you to picture this. They go up there, it's like an episode of Cops. They tell Jesus, turn around, put his hands behind his back, and they push him down on the hood of the cop car, and Peter goes, no, it ain't going down like this. And he grabs that sword out, and he takes a swing. And the only way you cut a guy's ear off is if you swing at his head and he ducks down and you just slash right over that thing. And that ear goes flying over there and lights on the ground. And Peter's like, anybody else want to lose an ear? He wasn't lying when he said, I'll die before I deny you. That's what he wanted to do. Nobody else yanked a sword out. Peter was the one doing the talking. Peter was the one doing the chopping. They all said, yeah, we're not going to do that. Can I tell you something? Peter's willpower was to follow Christ at all cost. If you doubt the sincerity and the will of Peter, you're stupider than he is. You're dumber than Peter if you don't think Peter really, really, really wanted to die serving Christ. The only way you'd take a swing at a public official with a sword is if you're ready to die to save Christ. What stopped Peter? Jesus, he said, put your sword away and hand me that ear. He put the ear back on. He put the ear back on the guy's head. Now, discussion for a different day, but if I'm arresting you and somebody cuts my ear off and the guy I'm arresting is able to reattach it without stitches, I'm probably going to give him a warning and send him on his way. This is a proud resistance. Peter says he'll die before he denies him. And he meant it. And the other 10 said, we feel the same way. And they meant it. Well, friend, what happened? What you want and your willpower is not enough apart from the work of the Holy Spirit. Let's apply this. Anybody here want to go to heaven when they die? I really, really do. I'll die to go to heaven. Peter would die to save Christ. My friend, your wants and your wishes and your devotion and your sincerity are not enough to determine what will happen between you and God, because you must rely on God to do everything you do. You know, people would get saved if I'd tell a sad story, play soft music, pull on their heartstrings and prick their emotions. I can persuade you to do a lot of things, but I can't persuade you to have any eternal value. Won't work. Won't matter. I can rally you to fight against the federal government, and we can all go out and die as some wacko group like Waco or Ruby Ridge. It will have no eternal value. It's not enough to will of your own might to accomplish any good thing for God. Look, what they were determining to do was a good thing. It was a biblical thing. It was the right thing. But it wasn't meant to be. Let me put it to you this way. How many times have we heard someone say, I'm going to go plant a new church, I'm going to start a new work, I'm going to go reach people, I'm going to go do this and that and this and that. You know what I used to say? After our church had a big fight, knockdown, drag out, split to try to fire me as pastor about 9 or 10 years ago, I said, you know, if they ever do that again, I'm just going to go quit and start my own church. And I won't have to put up with people like that anymore. Then I read that verse, upon this rock I will build my church. And I was like, ooh, my name wasn't in that verse. And he didn't ask Harold what he wanted to do. He said he's going to do the building. And I'm like, well, I'll just go out and get new people in the church. And then I read that verse, and the Lord added to the church daily, such as should be saved. And I was like, well, it just don't seem like he's asking me what I want. Just don't seem like he's consulting me about how I feel. And I thought it was a good thing to plant a church. And I thought it was a good thing to go get new people. And it is, and it's a right thing. But it cannot be done by my will or your will. It must be according to His will. And if He's not involved, it will not last. It will not work. Last week, I proposed to do a good thing. I'm going to go get away by myself in the mountains, and I'm not going to look at a Baptist nor a pagan. It's hard to tell the difference at times. For a week. That's a good thing. Go be away with the Lord. Plan some things. Yeah, didn't work. Didn't work. I was like, God, I'm trying to get alone with you and you're running it. I desired a good thing. I planned a good thing. I had preachers text me, praying you have a productive week alone with God this week. And I'm like, no, I'm not. You prayed, I prayed, they prayed. This people, it didn't work. Why? Wasn't his plan. Brother Harold, you must have done something wrong. No. Just wasn't his plan. It just didn't go according to plan. It didn't go according to my plan. But it went according to his plan. So what's the solution? We can close with this. Willpower ain't enough to do what's right. It just ain't enough. You can't doubt the will of Peter to defend Christ and give his life for him. That's what he sought to do. But that was not in God's plan. Now, God didn't forcefully drag Peter away. Jesus just said, put your sword away. That was all it took. The solution is this. You seek Christ. You seek Christ. That's what they were doing. Then you rely on Christ. And then you rise and fall on Christ. Let me put it to you this way. If you're seeking God and you're relying on God and it fails, it's God's will to fail. If you're seeking God and you're following God and the good times are God, the bad times are also of God. Now look, you can do things that are bad that bring bad times upon you. You can be dumb. Hey, look, if you don't partake of the Lord's Supper in the right way, you can become sick and some of you can die. It happened at Corinth. If it happened at Corinth, it can happen at Lee Creek. You can do bad things and bring the judgment of God upon you physically. But what if you're doing it right? What if your motives are right? What if what you're trying to do is right and it still fails? Rest in this. It was God's will to fail. It was God's will to fail. Thought about a missionary. I heard about this on my trip. I bought a pack of CDs off a traveling preacher. I had them rattling around in my car for 6 months. I was getting ready to go on this trip. I was cleaning out all the McDonald's wrappers from under the seat. And I pulled out this stack of CD. I'm just kidding. I don't eat McDonald's. I pulled out this stack of CDs. And I was like, oh, I forgot I bought them. So I got in that car and I popped him in and he was telling the story of a missionary, and I'll get his name wrong. There's two of them. They left England and they went to a row of islands that stretched between Hawaii and Sydney, Australia. I don't remember the name of the islands and I don't remember the two missionaries' names, but it's really not important. They raised all this support. The gospel had never been there. These two guys got there and they got on a ship and they convinced the guy to take them and drop them off on this island. And they got off on the island, and within 5 minutes, both of them were killed and put in a pot and eaten by cannibals. Within 5 minutes. I mean, the guy that was dropping them off was like they were coming out of the woods, spearing them. Then they were cutting them up. He said, well, it must not have been God's will for them to go there. Or maybe it was God's will for them to go and die there. Were their motives right? Sure. Spread the gospel to the pagan. Were they trying to accomplish a good thing? Sure. Why are we so quick to say there was something wrong with them when it could have been the will of God that that's how they die? You say, well, Brother Harold, I just do not know why in the world God would allow that. Well, it's not your business to know why God does what he does. But I'll give you the rest of the story. A missionary came a few years later, spent 41 years there, and their gospel church is on every island now. That wouldn't have happened if they hadn't ate the first two. The will of God is God's will. It's your job to do what you're supposed to do according to the scriptures. It's God's job to measure the outcome and the way it works. And if you propose to do something good, something biblical, and you set out to do that and you fail, don't feel like it's because you didn't have enough willpower. Accept it as the will of God and move on. It hurts. Peter was hurt. You know why Jesus told Mary Magdalene, go and tell my disciples and Peter? Because Peter was hurt. But when he came to the shoreline, do you know what conversation was recorded in Galilee? The conversation between Peter and Jesus. Here's why. When the sword is raised and the shepherd is struck and the sheep are scattered, those sheep are still gathered by the hand of him that struck the shepherd. If you're a child of God, the outcome may not be what you envisioned, but the Father of all the sheep still has his hands upon you. Amen.